Welcome to the Unending TBR podcast. Today, Alyssa and I had the chance to talk to a very special author, and thank you for joining us.
All right, welcome to the Unending TBR. I am here with Nicole and Michelle Greep. Michelle, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me today. I'm super excited to be here.
We are so excited to talk to you.
Very much so. I love your books. And after meeting you this past summer, Michelle, I knew we had to have you on. You've got some exciting things coming, but you've got some awesome, awesome books in your backlist. So we just wanted to talk to you about your work. And for someone who hasn't read one of your books, how would you describe your style of historical fiction?
I guess I would have to say I like to keep it real, you know, just like Dickens, one of my favorite authors. All the sights, all the smells, I want to take the reader back to whatever era I happened to be writing in at the time. And, you know, life was hard back then, but life is hard right now. So if I can make that connection between the past and the present, awesome. That's what I'm shooting for. And so, but that sometimes means that it can get a little gritty, but through it all, I try to weave in biblical truth and ultimately hope, because man, we all need hope.
Yeah.
I would say you definitely succeed in that. And what I love most about your books, and I think I've told you this before, is the way you write so vividly. So when you've got two characters having a conversation in a room, it's like I'm sitting there in the room. And like, I'm watching like the facial expressions and watching them have a conversation. And, you know, you've got action, you've got romance, you've got quick pacing. So I love all of that stuff, but it's just like you said, it's dipped in biblical truth. And it's always interesting to see what period you're going to write in.
Yeah. I mix it up because I get bored. And if I get bored, you know, my reader's going to get bored. So you never know what I'm going to be writing next.
I feel like your books are a good thing, even for, like, for my attention. Like, I don't think I have attention span problem, but when I started reading your books, it's like, oh, you get like the reader there like quickly. Like you set the setting, you have the dialogue, you have them doing something. And I'm like, you're so in the moment with them that I feel like it's a great bridge. Cause it's like, I used to be the person who thought it's like, oh, historical fiction. What's relevant about that, and how can that apply? But your books do have that thing about like the hope that we need at any time. And yeah, absolutely love that.
Truth is timeless. So mm-hmm. It doesn't really matter what era you're writing in. People are people, whether they lived thousands of years ago or right now, or even in the future, we're all going to struggle with the same human condition. That just doesn't change.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Unfortunately. Right.
Well, I have always loved historical fiction, and I think I found your work by, you know, being a good follower of Mary Lou Tyndall, who I know is close to you. I know we talked about that before, yeah. And I love to see, you know, her endorsements on your books and vice versa. So I think that's where I first found your name, but I think my first one that I really took seriously, I think I ordered in the middle of lockdown, was at the edge of the...
Yeah.
The House at the End of the Moor.
Ah, yes.
That one was really good. And I love that you do Victorian and Regency. But you really do a lot of things too.
A lot of people don't know the difference, honestly, between Victorian and Regency. But I will say Regency readers, they're pretty rabid and they know the parameters. So
yes. Yeah. So if for somebody who's listening, I know them, but, and I'm sure Nicole knows them, but for somebody who's listening, can you differentiate the Regency and Victorian a little bit? And tell us about the differences, your favorite differences and aspects of writing in each era.
Okay, sure. Regency is early 1800s. So roughly, I'm going to botch the dates, 1803 to like 1820-ish.
Right around. Yeah.
It's when the Prince Regent took over, because remember Nutty King George, who we rebelled against here, us colonial traitors, Yeah, that he wasn't quite able to manage the country. So it was his son, the Prince Regent, that took over. And he was pretty decadent. He was a party boy and was not into reigning with a tight fist at all. So it was kind of a party glory days, so to speak, early 1800s. And then we get lovely, lovely Queen Victoria, who comes into to play in the latter half. Gosh, I think she was around a good, I'm going to botch this too, 60 years, 1820.
Yeah.
She was 60 to 80 years. She was like until Edward, like she was around for a long time. And that's when we have the more, you know, stricter social mores, not that they weren't strict in the Regency era, but little less partying in the Victorian era. So a little more strict. But I would say what I love about the Regency era is, you know, Jane Austen and balls and gowns and romance and sassy dialogue. I love some good sarcasm. I really do. So that's kind of, you know, a good cut direct on the ballroom floor was quite the thing during the Regency era. Victorian, I can't help it. In my mind, I always equate that a little bit with steampunk. So I think a little more Sherlock Holmes, a little more, you know, gritty, coal smoke, Dickensian, intrigue, mystery, and that kind of thing. So it was still an uptight era. Definitely had social mores going on, but
well, and I feel, and with the like, if you ever do it with like the costumes, it's like the Victorian eras were the eras that where they actually had a waistline on the dress.
Yeah, you couldn't breathe. So I do prefer the Regency gowns much better because you can eat more. that's my personal take on the difference in the eras.
Okay, awesome. And, you know, we have to ask you, and this is actually Nicole's question, but okay, I'm going to ask it. If you were kidnapped, which one of your heroes would you want to be in charge of your rescue mission? And or who's your favorite swoony hero?
Oh my God.
Out of all your stories, Regency, Victorian, and you've done other eras too. So, you know, pick one or three, or who would you want to rescue? Who's your most swoony?
Oh my goodness. This is so hard, you guys. This is so hard. I would have to say if I had to get rescued, I would go with Samuel Thatcher, the noble guardian, because was it yours?
Yeah.
That man's been around the block a few times.
Yep. Okay.
So he knows what's up. He knows, he's going to know how to rescue you because that's what he does and what he does well. Plus he's kind of a handsome fella. So, you know, there's that. As for swoon worthy, not that he's not, of course he is. I do happen to have a favorite hero, and this is probably going to make readers a little angry because this book is out of print and you can't read about him because I haven't read about him. His name is Ragnar, and he's a Viking of all things. So I wrote this way back when with a very small publisher. This is before I had made it bigger. And so that company went out of business like after only 500 books it sold. So there's not that many out there to purchase right now. But I would have to say Ragnar is the man. He's my man. But good news, because I do want to reissue that. And I had a trilogy planned for it. I just got busy on the era. But I will revisit it. I will put out this Viking trilogy, and you can decide then what you think about Ragnar.
I remember when I was like looking for it, and there was like one copy at like $30, and I'd like waited hemmed and hawed, and then it was gone, and I was like, I missed my chance.
Are you guys talking about Gallimore?
No.
Undercurrent. It's Undercurrent.
Undercurrent. I don't have that one by you.
No, there's only 500 out there, and I think like on Amazon it's going for like $85 right now. So
yeah, we need you to get on that reprint.
I know, right? I need to, but I'm just too busy right now. I'm going to. I seriously will. But if you want another seaworthy hero, I would go with Samuel Heath from The Captive Heart.
That was who I was going to pick.
Oh, awesome. Okay. Well, then I pleased you both, right?
Yep. We're very happy.
Good. Yeah. He's more my Beauty and the Beast kind of hero.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely love that. I know. I love the variety that you have in there. And every one of them is like just those engaging stories. So thank you for that.
Well, thank you for being my readers. Couldn't do it without you.
So well, yeah. I'll let Nicole go because, okay. You know, I know she has a couple writing questions, so I'll let her throw those in there.
Okay, so, like, one thing that I mentioned is, like, how you tackle that pacing and everything like that with your novels. What do you feel is key to that, to keep your readers engaged in that historical setting? What do you, like, employ anything, or is that, like, how the story presents itself to you in your head?
It's kind of like a dance, and in that there's so much history that I could include, but that if I, it's going to be nonfiction and you're going to get bogged down in it. So there's a fine line between engaging you in the era, but keeping the story moving ahead. And so I like to try to do that with a mix of, I like to throw in some humor because I don't want it to get too dark.
Yeah.
But then I want to have intrigue and scary parts so that you have to turn the page and say, oh my goodness, what's going to happen next? So it's kind of a blend of all those things, intrigue, romance, history, just kind of keeping it going back and forth and until the very end.
Okay. Great.
So which one of your books do you feel like was the biggest challenge to keep that pacing going? Like, was there a book that was harder to write than others?
There was. It is A Tale of Two Hearts, which is the second story in Once Upon a Dickens Christmas. Yeah, that was a tricky one. And here's why. The hero, oh my goodness, I'm blanking on his name now. I've got too many hero names.
William? Will?
I think it was Will. Yeah. You are correct. You win a prize. It's William Barlow. That was it.
I just read this like 2 months ago. So
okay. You're more focused on it than I am. I've got way too many other characters in my head at the moment. But that was a really hard one for me to write because he's a hero who is basing things on deceit. Like, he's lying that the heroine is his wife and she's not. And yet she's playing along with it. And so, because she loves him. But so how do I make that deceitful tendency heroic? That was the fine line I had to walk in that one. So I had to have him really struggling with what he was doing, with what he was trying to accomplish. And of course, then changing by the end of the story. But it was a challenge to make him likable while he was.
Well, I think you succeeded.
Well, thank you. That was really hard for me. That was a tough one.
It was good. Well, and I actually wanted to mention the first one in that series, which is The 12 Days at Bleakley Manor, which I believe what you want a Christie for, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. And the reason I have to bring this up is because there are two stories that obviously made me think about this that I thought of when I was reading this. Obviously, Bleak House by Charles Dickens. And we won't go into too many spoilers, but oh my word, as somebody who loves the Bleak House miniseries, I loved, loved, loved the story. And then I don't know if you've ever heard of And Then There Were None by Agatha Christie. Oh,
absolutely. It was a mashup.
Yeah, it did feel like a mashup.
It was. I like to mash things together. I really do.
I've read that one the last couple of Christmases because it's just like, it's a treat to read a Bleak House Agatha Christie mashup in Victorian England at Christmas time. Like, you can't get any better.
Who'd have thunk, right? Yeah.
And I feel like with that one too, it's like, again, back to the pacing. It's so hard to find like novellas that feel complete enough. And it's like, that was like the perfect blend. Cause it's like so many times it's like during Christmas time, you're so busy. And it's like the perfect bite size, but still so satisfying.
Good. Novellas are a challenge for me because there's so much I want to put into them and I can't. So it's got to shoehorn it all in.
Yeah.
Well, you'll be glad to know that my next project that I actually need to start on next week is another Victorian Christmas story. No idea what it is. Not a clue, but I'll come up with something.
Well, I'm very excited for that. You've also got some really cool stuff happening, and I'm going to pretend like I know nothing about it, although I know you and I have talked and you've announced, because all of our listeners may not know about your new series with Bethany House, your third installment of Blackfriars Lane. So let's start with Blackfriars Lane. That comes out, I believe, in April. Yeah. That's the third installment of Kit and Jackson. Tell us about that and what you're excited about, and about their story a little.
Okay. I'm super excited for this one just because I love Kit and Jackson. They're just so much fun to write. You never know what kind of trouble they're going to get into, and it's probably going to be Kit's fault. for this next one coming out, it's called The Sleuth of Blackfriars Lane, and I am a huge fan of Miss Scarlet and the Duke. I don't know if you've seen
me
that.
Me too. I love it.
Yeah, right? So that influenced me a lot in the writing of this one, as did, have you seen Enola Holmes?
Yes.
Yeah, that one influenced me too for this one. So the sleuth, of course, is going to be Kit, but she's going to have a partner. That is her father. So he's retiring from the police force, and of course, you know, he's the grouchy old bear and she's the let's go get those bad guys girl. So they're gonna have some clashes, and she's married now to Jackson, and he takes on the chief inspector position at the station, and so of course they're gonna be at odds with him. So a little bit of, you know, the William and Miss Scarlet kind of conflict going on there. So again, another mashup of different stories, but it all comes together at the end. So yeah, that comes out April 1st.
I love that one so much. And so much so that when I read the first one, when I started watching Miss Scarlet and the Duke, I did a mashup reel of Miss Scarlet and the Duke and your Blackfriars Lane series.
Oh, fun.
It was an aesthetic reel to the Miss Scarlet and the Duke theme. Cause I love it. It's so good. I love your books are way better than the show. I love the show, but they're keeping that long burn going way too long. So I love your books more.
Way too long. It's like, come on people, let's get this moving.
Yes. Which is why I love your books. Happily ever after, as always.
The funny thing is, when I first started the Blackfriars series, I didn't even know about Miss Scarlet and the Duke. It wasn't even out yet. And so the idea came from a children's animated movie called Zootopia. Have you seen or heard of that one?
Yes.
Zootopia?
Zootopia. So, you know, Kit's the bunny rabbit going to go to Zootopia. Or no, sorry. Jackson's the rabbit going to go to Zootopia, London, and whip it into shape, right? And the fox, that's Kit. She's
Kit.
A conniving little shyster who's gonna
and my mind is blown right now.
I absolutely love this. This is like epic.
This is amazing.
Zootopia, that's what it is. Yeah.
Well, but clearly you made it your own, and only the way that you can, with action, adventure, mystery, romance, humor, all of that perfectly paced. Love it. So, what can you share about your upcoming stuff with Bethany House?
Okay, I can share some things. So,
okay, good.
I'm just finishing the second book in this new series. It is Time's Lost Treasures series. And each book will feature a different archaeologist of some different, you know, culture. So, for instance, first book is of Golden Secrets. No, wait, of Golden Shadows. That's it. Second one's of Silver and Secrets. So hopefully I can keep those straight. But yeah, in the first one, the heroine is a wannabe Egyptologist because her dad's a professor of Egyptology at Oxford. And so, of course, he's out of the country, so she's going to take over over for him, which is always a bad idea because she's a lot like Kit. So, and she ends up going to work for, you know, the most eligible rich bachelor of in the country. And yeah, sparks will fly in more directions than you can imagine. So that's the first book. Second book features actually one of the characters in the first book. And he's a professor of Roman history at Trinity College in Cambridge. So in the first book, you've got, you know, Egyptology and Oxford. Second book, you've got Roman antiquities and Cambridge. So he's going to actually do a dig in England on the heroine's property, who, lo and behold, they happened to be friends when they were young children, and he was not such a nice fella back then and got sent away. But so is he reformed or not? I don't know. You'll have to read it.
I love both of these stories so much. I love treasure hunt archaeology. I wanted to be an archaeologist when I was a kid. And then I realized that you have to be in the heat and the dust and the bugs. And I was like, I think I'll do something safer. But basically, when I said I wanted to do archaeology, I wanted to be in the Girls of National Treasure. I mean, that was what I wanted for my job.
Okay.
Because that's realistic. So I, long story short, just love this idea of like archaeology. And now, what time period is it in?
Victorian. So.
Okay. That's what I thought. But.
Yeah. And the first book, you know me and my mashups. First book, I was thinking Indiana Jones and the Mummy kind of mashup thing. So,
which are two of my favorite movies. So
I love them too.
Oh, I just am so excited for this series. Are you able to share any kind of release time window? Year even? Do you know what year that will come out?
Yes, I will actually be revealing the cover soon. Like I think in a few weeks. I need to find out when that was. I don't remember. I think it's in March. But the book comes out, I believe, in September, the first book.
Ooh. Oh my word. I am so excited. I thought we'd have to wait longer.
No, that one should be out next fall. The second one should be out, gosh, I don't know. That's a good question. I think the following year. And then they want this Victorian Christmas thing that's just a standalone. So,
well, you're literally on fire. You're in demand. I love it. I love it.
No kidding, because I'm still writing for Barber, and I still have to do the third of Monsters and Men, which I think is Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, right?
I don't think I realized this.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, I got a lot of things going on. I don't even know what day it is.
Oh my word, you should see my face right now, listeners, because Nicole and I just got really excited. So what can you tell us about that one that's coming, if anything?
Which one, The Monsters and Men?
Oh yeah.
That one, like I say, it's going to be a riff on Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde. So I need to have, of course, Robert Louis Stevenson as a side character.
Of course.
Of course.
And that's all I know. That's all I got. That's it. Well, I'll think about it when I get to it.
That's enough of a taste for us to just remain as excited as we were when we remember that was coming out. We're so excited. Now, out of all of those things that are coming, you know, what themes or tropes do you kind of foresee in terms of like redemption or, you know, any kind of things that you kind of, and if you want to leave it a secret, that's fine. But if you want to kind of reveal like, hey, this is going to be a really good, strong theme in this, you know, what's your favorite coming up in terms of that?
Well, I mean, obviously there's the boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl. We got to have the romance in there. Otherwise, what's the point for me? Excuse me. But I would have to say God's sovereignty. You know, we're always trying to run ahead and arrange our own lives. I know I am. I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, or I'm going to fix this, I'm going to fix that. And then God laughs and says, it's not going to go that way. So it's going to go this way. And which definitely makes me crabby at the time. but it turns out to be a better way every single time. So that's kind of a common trope that I use in my books for different characters.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
What do you feel like with these characters? So, I mean, you have to have like a lot of stories in your head, I'm sure, at the same time, if all these things are going through. Do you feel like you have a character in one of the books that's really resonating with you, like personally at this time?
Kit's me. Risk taker, don't know what's coming out of my mouth next. You know, kind of fly by the seat of my pants. I am Kit. But I guess for in the book, the next book's coming out, I would say I am more Amy Dalton, who's the heroine in of Golden Shadows. Because again, she's another risk taker. And is gonna be the best at what she does because she wants to be, but she is flawed like we all are, right? So yeah. Has to somehow come to terms with that. So I resonate with that because I do that a lot.
Yeah. Well, and something else that you do in a lot of your books that I love, and I've mentioned this on my Instagram before, is you love to give a villain's point of view.
I do.
In your stories. You do. And tell us about that, because that's one of the favorite things I love about your books.
I don't do it in every book, but I do love to do it because I want to know what's going on in his head. And for some odd reason, it just flows. Like, I don't know, like a villain or what, but it just comes. So maybe I have a villain in me somewhere, but I do like to get in the villain's head and see what he's thinking sometimes. And it, you know, it kind of mixes up the story. You get a little, I get a little bored if it's just hero, heroine. I like to mix it up and throw something different in there every now and then.
That way you know something that way the reader knows something that the characters don't know, right? It's kind of like, they're totally in the dark about this. It can build suspense.
But it's also a way to tug at the reader's heartstrings. So for instance, in Lost in Darkness, I had the brother's point of view and I don't want to give it spoilers away, but it does tug at the heartstrings, hopefully, because that's what I was going for.
Absolutely. Well, another one that, you know, you really use as a crucial character arc is in The House at the End of the Moor, Edge of the Moor. Mm-hmm. I could mess up that title. And I obviously no spoilers, but that villain's arc is really interesting. So and that was one of the first ones I like truly read by you. And I was like, this is so cool. So
yeah, you never know what I'm going to do with a villain. You never know. Because I don't know what I'm going to do with him. At the end of a story, you know, he might get his just reward and something horrible happens to him. Or he might do a complete 180 and turn into a good guy. You don't know, because that's kind of humanity, right? We don't know who's going to turn around, who's going to change.
Yeah.
So true.
Yeah.
Well, tell us a little bit about your research process as you write. So what unexpected, surprising things maybe have you uncovered? Some things that you thought were really cool that you wanted to include it as like an Easter egg, or really anything about your research process. Tell us about that.
Okay, well, research for me is just another excuse to buy books, which because I have too many books, but I love them. So definitely books is my go-to. However, I do like to listen to experts on a subject as well. So maybe I've even written to some, you know, just cold call, like, I'll just shoot this out to this expert professor at, you know, Harvard, and doggone, they usually answer. It's so interesting.
That's amazing.
It is. It's so cool. Or I will listen to podcasts, people talking on that. So one interesting tidbit, I didn't include this in the story, but I thought it was really interesting. It's a whole different viewpoint that I never heard of. When I was researching Egypt, you know, you got your usual pyramids and whatnot, but there's this theory out there on the pyramids that perhaps they were not really burial tombs for pharaohs, but instead they were used before the Egyptians got there by a different civilization. They were built specifically as like chemical factories. And so this civilization used them to store ammonia and different things. I don't even remember what all the chemicals were because I am not scientifically minded, but they would then use this to power their city. So I thought, oh my goodness, I never heard that before, which I thought was super interesting. So a whole different theory, whole different take on what the pyramids were for. Because usually, you know, they'll get on the trail of, oh, they were for aliens, or, oh, they were pharaoh's tombs. But this was like,
so,
they were chemical
plants. So wait a minute. So the pyramids were actually the powerhouse for Atlantis.
There's a story.
I need one of you guys to write that so I can read it. My 90s baby Disney nerd heart who loves the Atlantis movies needs you to write this. Somebody needs to write this, please.
I'm a little booked up at the moment, so it's all yours.
Oh my goodness, that is so interesting. So what do you do if you're like in the research throes about things? And I'm sure like you said, how some, especially historical fiction readers, they're like, oh, that's not true. You know, this is true. They can be very dogmatic about that. What if in your research, you find two conflicting answers? Which one do you usually, what makes you pick one or the other?
If I find something really conflicting and I can only find two sources, one that says this and one that says that, I won't use it. I'm gonna stay away from that because yes, you are right. If I make an error in my books, I am gonna hear about it because readers, especially in the Regency era, are gonna let me know. And so I'm super careful about what I put in historically. And if I do tweak things, I will put a note in the back of my book, an author's note, a historical note saying, okay, this is what really happened. I tweaked it to say or do this. So, yeah.
I love your author's notes because I always find the coolest historical facts and history nuggets in your author's notes. Those are always fun.
Oh, there are so, I could look on historical notes. There's so many I can put in there. So I have to just really glean it down to not overwhelm readers.
It's like that little appendix in the back. I love reading the author's notes too, especially like some authors like yourself that it's like, okay, I'm actually, in some cases, I can't wait to get to the author's notes because I'm like, now I want to know like how she found this, you know? So that is so cool.
Oh, yeah. I full on flip to the back sometimes and read them, which I'm not opposed to spoilers. So like if it kind of reveals anything, but I just, otherwise, I love your author's notes, which is, I'm sure, weird to be complimented on all, you have read a whole book, and we love your books, but your author's notes are so cool.
I have heard that before, so not okay. A surprise. I need to confess, I have a true confession time, that if I'm reading a book, and it's super intense, and I'm afraid a character's going to die, I will skip to the last page and find out if that character is still alive.
Yeah. Me too. Nicole hates that about me.
That makes so many people mad.
The thing is, sometimes it's like we go for fiction for reassurance sometimes, and we need to be reassured about what's going to happen.
I can't handle the stress if I don't know that it has a happy ending. And that's why all of your books have happy endings. And like, but like, I can't handle the stress, and I've been known to like flip to the back and know who to root for, or I know like, okay, it's kind of all gonna be okay in the end, like that.
Yeah, I do that too.
Yeah.
So what are you reading right now? What do you enjoy reading other than research?
Oh, I read across genres. Like I am all over the board. I read, and I don't just read Christian. I do read a lot of inspirational, but I'll read general market stuff as well. Okay. So, currently I'm just going to start The Paris Betrayal, by James Hannibal, which is, he's a Christian author, and it's an espionage kind of, you know, Jason Bourne type book, I will say. So can't tell you if it's any good because I haven't started it yet, but I did just finish, a secular book that was called Dark Matter. It was a New York Times bestseller back in 2016. Super mind-bending, it's this astrophysicist who creates this box and ends up like his destiny diverges in this box. And so it creates like 90 or 100 of them. Like, oh, what if I didn't make this choice in life?
Oh.
And this would happen. Well, that person still lives. And oh, what if I didn't make this choice in life? Well, that person still lives. And so they all converge in one big scene at the end of the book. It's like, oh my goodness, this is crazy. It was really good.
That's so cool.
Yeah, that's what I'm reading right now.
Do you feel like reading across genres helps with your creativity?
I think it does. And it really helps with, different writing styles. Mm. So, you know, this last one I read was definitely more of a thriller. So very short, choppy sentences. Whereas, you know, if I'm going to read a classic by Charlotte Bronte or Jane Austen, it's going to be long, flowing, beautiful words, which I love beautiful words, but I want to mix it up and have those different kinds of writing in me. So I also love poetry. So Carl Sandburg all the way, he's my man. And I love science fiction. So Ray Bradbury. So, you know, it's just like, I'm all over the place. I'm just all over.
That's so cool. Well, what impact do you hope that your books will have on readers?
I hope that I reach readers where they're at, in the respect that we do all have really hard things that we go through in life, every single one of us. And how are we going to navigate through that? And ultimately, it's God that we need to have in our lives to navigate through those problems. And so ultimately, I want to drive readers to God, whether they realize it or not. Mm. You know, I want them to have that hope that, yeah, there is somebody out there looking out for me, and his name is God, and I can know him. So yeah, biblical truth, want to weave it in the story. I don't necessarily want to beat the reader over the head with Bible verses, but to incorporate it into my character's lives so that a reader can relate with the character and then ultimately be driven to the same source that character is going to, which is God.
Mm.
You have definitely done that for me, and certainly done that for a lot of readers. I know your books are an escape when I'm stressed out. I am like all of a sudden transported to another time, another place, but they've also got some really like deep points. I have little book darts, little bookmarks all throughout some of your books, which is just like little grains of truth that are woven in and with your relatable characters. But, you know, it's your books are an escape, but also bring you to a realistic view of God, if that makes any sense. So love, love your stories. Love your work. So excited for what's coming next.
Yeah, good. Because I've been working like crazy.
Clearly.
Yeah. Yes, very much.
Right. Well, what are some places that listeners can follow you? I know, but tell the listeners where they can find you on different sites and stuff.
Absolutely. So the easiest place to find me is my website, which is just michellegriep.com. You can keep up with my books there. You can read a little bit about me. You can contact me even if you'd like to. So yeah, that's my website. Otherwise, the bulk of my readership I find is on Facebook, of all places. So I have an author page, just Michelle Griep on Facebook. It's the author page. I mean, there's my personal page, but I will post more writing related things on my author page. So that's a good place to find me. Otherwise, Instagram, I love the pretty pictures. Instagram's a good place to find me also. And BookBub, you know, Goodreads. If you want to know what I think about a book that I've read, I post brutally honest reviews on Goodreads. So I'll tell you exactly what I think. And Pinterest. I love Pinterest. I waste so much time on Pinterest. Each of my boards has a book. Each of my books has
a book. Has a board.
Flip that around. Yeah, I always have an inspirational board for each of my books. So that's usually where I'll start a book, is I'll start collecting images of people, of things, of moods, and put it all on Pinterest. So, oh, and Spotify, I have my channel. I make a playlist for each book too. So I have.
Really?
Yeah. I have music in the background when I'm writing. So, you know,
oh.
Moody, emotional book music. So, yeah,
who are you on Spotify? Is it your same name on Spotify too?
I think it's just M Greep because I was too lazy to call it Michelle.
Yeah. Well, and then you've also got your Inspirational Regency Readers group on Facebook too, which is always fun too.
Yeah, that is an active group. That Inspirational Regency Readers is the brainchild of Erica Vetch. And she has me and Julie Clausen as partners in crime. And so Erica comes up with these wild ideas of, oh, we should do this and we should do that. And I'm like, yeah, let's do it. And Julie's like, no, wait a minute, girls, let's think about this. So we're quite the trio, which is fantastic. We need each other. And so, yeah, Inspirational Regency Readers. That's a fun group to be in.
Yes, it is. Well, Michelle, thank you so much for joining Nicole and I.
Thank you for having me. I love being here and chatting, reading and writing and everything. Just, yeah, you guys are great. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Well, you can follow Nicole and I on Instagram as well as Michelle. And we look forward to talking with you again sometime, Michelle.
I would love to come back. Thank you.
Oh, thanks.
Thank you for listening, and until next time, make your TBR the unending.